Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. Today, we're discussing the Trump administration's unprecedented attacks on museums and cultural institutions. Shortly after taking office, Trump issued an executive order accusing the Smithsonian Museums of promoting divisive, race-centered ideology. The order calls on J.D. Vance and other members of the administration to, quote, remove improper ideology from Smithsonian Museums, education, and research centers, and the National Zoo, end quote. On August 19th, on his Truth Social, Trump wrote, quote, the Smithsonian is out of control, where everything discussed is how terrible our country is, how bad slavery was, and how unaccomplished the downtrodden have been. Nothing about success, nothing about brightness, nothing about the future. He went on to write, I have instructed my attorneys to go through the museums and start the exact same process that has been done with colleges and universities where tremendous progress has been made, end quote. CNN reports that museum leaders have largely remained silent, and some are self-censoring exhibits and programs that could provoke federal ire. The group Citizen Historians for the Smithsonian are taking photos of exhibits before they're changed or removed. Over 750 people are volunteering, and in just 5 weeks, the project has documented more than 30,000 photographs and videos. Joining us to discuss what's at stake and the precedent this sets are two guests. Dr. Peniel Joseph is professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the university's Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Professor Joseph focuses on the intersection of race, democracy, civil, and human rights. He's the author and editor of 8 books, including his latest, Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed the Civil Rights Revolution. Hi, Professor Joseph. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Dr. Saida Grundy is feminist sociologist of race and ethnicity studies and associate professor of sociology and African American Black Diasporic Studies and Women's and Gender Studies at Boston University. Her research focuses on formations and ideologies of gender and politics within the Black middle class and elites, specifically men. Professor Grundy is author of the award-winning book, Respectable, Politics and Paradox in Making the Morehouse Man. Hi, Professor Grundy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's really great to be on and to be joining my longtime friend and colleague, Peniel Joseph.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Before we dive in and talk about the Smithsonian Museums, I'd like to ask both of you what it's like to be professors in this climate. We recently invited a professor from Southern California to join us, and they said, I'm laying low right now because my family is receiving death threats. Unfortunately, I cannot join you. So, Saida, let's start off with you. What is it like to be a fairly outspoken professor in this climate?
You know, to tell you the truth, I don't know any other way to be. I think it was bred into me because I am, you know, a baby of, you know, Black power movements, a baby of the Black arts movement, which I think we'll be discussing today. The idea of being under threat, what I am, you know, I have experienced in my career, doesn't compare at all to what I know has happened to, you know, my parents' generation, their cohort, to people who were exiled, you know, to Assata Shakur, whose memory we should uphold today, as she just passed, right? So I always feel like any complaints I have are so minuscule and so minor that it doesn't even feel like complaints. It feels like the price of admission for living, right, in a way in which you can be a credit to a struggle, right? So I always consider myself as an academic to just be a member of the research wing of a movement against white nationalism, against white supremacy, and a movement for Black liberation in a very pan-African sense. And in that, research wing, I always consider myself just, it's a bit of a luxury what I do. I haven't suffered many of the blows that others in the struggle have. So I say it with that. I say it with a great sense of humility in what we do.
What is the climate like today at Boston University? Is there anything we need to know about what's happening on campus?
Let's see. My BU students are very engaged, as I think the country knows. The East Coast, Boston in particular, particularly urban private elite universities have really been on the list, basically. The Trump has a list, right? I'm not speaking hyperbolically. We know there's an actual list of universities to target. Of course, the Ivies have been, the top of that list, I think, because of their profile. But it's only there's a bit of a playing of, ostrich sticking heads in the sand that these universities are doing now in terms of let's just duck and hope he sues the next guy. But we know that that's not a real strategy, right? That we know there has to be a much stronger defense in the solidarity across these universities, and that we're really weakened when any of us folds and any of us capitulates. So, I would hope that the climate up here is one of doing a lot of behind the scenes organizing across these universities to have some sense of coalition. But the climate at BU in terms of our students, my students, I'm so proud. And I think that if anything that this past year has taught me, or really it's confirmed what I already knew, is that, faculty, although we have a reputation of being a little bit, on Mars and a little bit, unmoored from the bureaucracies and the day-to-days of the university, I think students and faculty know that we very much are standing arm in arm against really suppression of dissent, right? I'm so proud of my colleagues across the country who have been arrested, who've lied on the ground while they were. I'm talking about emeritus 65-year-old women being tackled to the ground by police, being handcuffed because we were in solidarity with our students and their protests. And I think I speak for many of us that, you have to come through our students, you have to come through us.
And this was because of the protests about the horror in Gaza.
Absolutely. To which
Right.
I'm just very, I always ask people, what do you want? This complaint that, young people are apathetic, and then they display that they are quite the opposite, that they're highly engaged politically, and that every generation has called for an end to human atrocities. Why would Gaza be an exception, right? So I'm very proud of my students on that tip.
That is Dr. Saida Grundy, Associate Professor of Sociology and African American Black Diasporic Studies at Boston University. We're also joined today by Dr. Peniel Joseph, Professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. What would you like to add, Peniel? What is it like to be a professor in this climate?
Well, I would say Texas has been a huge challenge, and Texas has, at the state level and with the ledge passed SB 17 a couple of years ago, they fired over 65 largely Black and Brown and women and queer employees connected to DEI at the University of Texas at Austin. There's been massive turnover. We've got a new president. We've had about four provosts in a very, very short amount of time. So I would say that in Texas, there's been professors who've been fired for speaking out on the Middle East and other topics. Professor at Texas State was fired. They're trying to do reviews. They've announced reviews of all gender-related courses in Texas. So Texas has really delved into a really Orwellian hole Definitely morally reprehensible and politically indefensible. But I would say that here, and again, I would, I agree with my friend Sai, who's terrific. I agree with what she's saying. I think that all of us who are faculty, and this reminds me of studying Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement, it really is state by state and local. So over here, what we're experiencing here, just like I don't know exactly what people are experiencing in Boston or Mississippi, I don't even know exactly what people are experiencing in Houston, but Austin, it's really, really bad. So Austin, so there is, and I think faculty have tried, but it's been an enormous challenge, and especially for Black faculty. For female faculty, Black women faculty, queer faculty, disabled faculty, it's really been a series of public and private humiliations that they didn't really deserve because these are human beings. So it's been very, very painful. It's been very, very difficult. And I can't, what I won't do as a historian is just compare eras. What I'll say is that everybody sort of has to face the challenges of their own eras, right? And so it's been really a hugely dispiriting time, even as those of us who are in movements and we have friends and family and we have solidarity there, that's true. But it's been, it's kind of like, Toni Morrison teaches us that, racism is there to distract us from our work, right? So it's prevented a lot of healing and a lot of creativity and a lot of art, even as some of that art is still going to flow, the rose through the concrete, it's still coming up. But it's really done. And I was talking about this at Asala. I was at our convention for the Black Scholars conventions. Over 1,200 of us were there in Atlanta, Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History, which was an organization founded by Carter G. Woodson in 1915. And he, the Miseducation of the Negro, Harvard PhD. But it's such a great conference because you have so many Black women and men and young scholars who get together annually. But people came in the spirit of real healing and solidarity and love and justice because what's happening, and again, I've talked to my colleagues in Florida, talked to colleagues in Ohio, obviously other Texas colleagues. People are losing their jobs and their livelihoods, and so we can't discount that because we have an American Association of University Professors, which is trying, but we don't have a big union or collective bargaining association. I'm coming from a labor background. My mom was part of SEIU 1199, so I'm it was on my first picket line at 7 years old. So we're in huge we're in huge trouble in that sense, right? So it's really impacting people's lives. And there are a lot of people who are very, very courageous, but there are some people who are trying to just protect their families and pivot because people have children. I'm a father. People have children and have health care for them. Sometimes they have children who have chronic illnesses, which means if they lose their jobs, if they have a child who has diabetes, type 1 diabetes, if they have a child with any kind of chronic illness, that's a huge impact on their child for speaking truth to power. So this has been an enormously difficult time, which makes people have to think about their moral and ethical choices in different ways, because the more resources we have, the more principled we can be in our actions and our activities. I can say this as a father, if it was between my daughter's life and having to steal food for her so she could eat, I'm robbing everybody in terms of for my baby girl. So those we've all had to reassess, but I will say this, what's happening right now is wrong. It's morally wrong. It's reprehensible. And you can see why Dr. King wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail, because there's so many people, and it's not just white people, there's so many people who are willing to capitulate in the face of what is wrong and what is morally and politically evil and unjust. And I think for a lot of us who are Gen Xers and millennials, we had not been alive long enough to see this. You know, so I'm 52. We hadn't been long enough alive to see it at this level, at this level. And you know, the media capitulating, not present company, right? But the media capitulating, and look, PBS being bankrupted, right? So we're seeing something that in the history of modern America we had never seen, because even the McCarthy period wasn't as successful in its proliferation and weaponization of justice and racial equality as this current period. And it's been really disappointing to see the number of people and institutions and organizations and outlets who capitulate. And that's why, again, when we talk about whether we talk about the museums or the Middle East or homelessness or poverty, you want justice for everyone. Because when you silo a part of the world and say it's okay to mistreat these people for whatever reason, we all become affected. We're implicated in that, but it boomerangs back to us, which is what Malcolm said about chickens coming home to roost. So it's been a really difficult time.
I think you make so many good points, especially about what is at stake for people who have families to feed. And healthcare is related in most cases to our jobs. And so if we have children, like you said, with chronic disease, it's really hard to possibly give that up. And CNN has this piece about how many museum leaders are remaining silent. And one of the reasons is because they're afraid of losing their tax-exempt status. And this is according to this CNN piece. And I want to give credit to Jackie Palumbo for writing this. And she's spoken to people who say if museums lose their tax-exempt status, the small museums just can't make it. And so these small museums might have to shut their doors, and then people lose their jobs and their livelihoods. And Saida, this is something that I feel has not gotten much attention about all of these government workers who are losing their jobs. And then to focus on the museums, which we're talking about today, there's so much at stake. These people do not want Trump's attention.
Absolutely. And really, again, bravo to the journalists who have really done their job about tracking this. So we know that federal employees, partly because of where DC is located, have been disproportionately, Black, historically, and the layoffs, the firings, right, the clearing house has affected disproportionately Black women in particular. I really appreciated a piece a few months ago in the Times about like this is a style of affirmative action that's for white men only, right? We see this replicated throughout these various branches of the government right now, and the government overreach. So government reach into, universities, government reach into the arts community has been about the erasure and the elimination of really just people they believe who should not have a voice or should not have authority in any of these institutions. And it's absolutely disproportionately affecting people who were already vulnerable, who are already socially vulnerable, et cetera. I keep using to give your listeners a sense of the scope of what's at stake here. I keep using the analogy of the Sahara Desert, which was once the Sahara Savannah, which was once verdant and lush and green. And there's a vast ecological system that it takes to not only sustain that savanna, but to expand it, right? Everything from the bat guano to, to the predators, to the prey, to, droplets of pollen, on leaves of palm trees sustains that ecosystem. But it only takes one resource to evaporate it, right? Like the withdrawal of water is what creates a desert, but you can't water a desert to recreate a savanna, right? So we're looking at 50, 100 years of consequence from what's happening now. And it's not something that can just be restored by watering it with money again. right? We're losing an ecosystem on which we all depended for knowledge, for truth, for the arts.
Right. And this is another good point. And if for people who want to read the piece you just cited, it's so important. In Trump's federal workforce cuts, Black women are among the hardest hit by Eric Green. Before we go to break, just because so much of what we're covering these days is pretty dark, to be frank, I want to make sure that we actually celebrate some of these museums. Because there's so much focus on the things that Trump has said. I mean, to think on one hand, you just shake your head, but at the same time, to think that he wrote the Smithsonian is too focused on, quote, how bad slavery was. Before we go to break, can we just celebrate the National Museum of African American History and Culture? Because
Yes.
it is such an amazing museum. I'll never forget the first time I walked into that museum. And in your latest piece in The Guardian, or one of your latest pieces, Saida, Trump's attacks on the Blacksonian have a history in a century-old myth. You point out that since it opened in 2016, it has welcomed more than 10 million visitors, with families and school groups driving much of that number. There's 7 floors, there's 12 galleries. I mean, it is an amazing museum. Can you just talk about what it was like for you when you first visited?
Absolutely. Absolutely. First of all, it felt, getting tickets to that museum, which I think the public needs to understand, the Smithsonian operates on free tickets, right? They're time-stamped free tickets. But getting tickets to that museum was like getting tickets to a Beyoncé concert. I had to have my friends in government hook me up with tickets for my family. It just felt like I had a Willy Wonka golden ticket. Went with my family. My nephews were very small at the time. And I had, I was having a multitude of experiences, both like as a tourist, but also as a scholar. And I think what impressed me first and foremost was, first of all, just the design of it. You start literally at the foundation of the building, right? As one who's like sort of an architecture geek, this was like, this was fantastic to me. You're starting at the belly of the building. And that's where the exhibit's about. Not only, it doesn't start with the Middle Passage, so it doesn't start the story of Black people with what Europeans did to us. It starts with African civilizations. And so you get an appreciation of all that was lost by slavery, which I think is very lost in the narrative that we tell about slavery. We often tell it as, sort of, what damage could it have done? Black people didn't really have anything before that. What was happening in Africa? Well, Africa was one of the most advanced multiple civilizations in all of humanity. And so it starts there. And so you get this tremendous through line. And I just remember thinking as a scholar, one, recognizing the name, recognizing my colleagues' work in all of these, right? Like, oh, I know the historian whose, book this would be, based on. I know who does, Queen Jenga. I know, recognizing that. And so having this real appreciation for how much consulting the museum organizers did with these experts, and just feeling all of my senses were just immersed in this guided tour that I felt like, I could spend weeks in here. And then you to give a sense of the emotionality, you begin with the sense of a greatness, or a contribution of African people's past, and you emerge with a sense of our future. And I can't stress enough how necessary that was, and particular gratitude expressed to Secretary Lonnie Bunch, the fights he has fought behind the scenes. He is just such a politically savvy, really informed secretary of the Smithsonian. He is on the ground every day with his staff, with his curators, to really emerge with this great sense of not just hope in a very, in a very canned way, but this real sense of this isn't the last of our chapters. That's what that museum really gave me.
Well, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, Peniel, after a break. But before that, I want to play a clip. So Lonnie Bunch is the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, first African American head of the Smithsonian, first historian leading the Smithsonian. In 2015, he was founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And in 2015, 60 Minutes ran an incredible piece about what it took to build and create the museum. And Scott Pelley asked founding director Lonnie Bunch what America will have when the museum is finally complete.
America will have a place that allows them to remember how much we as a country have been improved, changed, challenged, and made better by the African American experience. They'll have a place that they can call home, but they'll also have a place that will make them change.
And I hope that you take the 13 minutes to watch the 60 Minutes piece, because it is so incredible to learn about and see how this incredible museum was built. Just to think about how many hours people spent, the decisions that were made, how they came up with the text, where they got all of these objects. That is an incredible part of this story. Families just came with so many objects from their ancestors and wanted the public to see. They wanted the public to learn about their past and about their families. So you can find that piece at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Today we're joined by Dr. Syeda Grundy, feminist sociologist of race and ethnicity studies and associate professor of sociology and African American Black Diasporic Studies at Boston University, author of Respectable: Politics and Paradox in Making the Morehouse Man. Dr. Peniel Joseph is professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin, and author of many books, including Freedom Season: How 1963 Transformed the Civil Rights Revolution. Today on Your Call, we continue our special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. We're talking about Trump's unprecedented attacks on museums and cultural institutions. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we continue our special series, The Authoritarian Playbook, by discussing Trump's unprecedented attacks on museums and cultural institutions. If you have any questions or comments, if you've been following this issue, what are your thoughts about what he has written on Truth Social, saying that the Smithsonian is out of control, focusing too much on how bad slavery was? But there's also a detailed letter to Lonnie Bunch about what museums have to do in the next 30, 60, 120 days. There's also a very detailed list about what this administration does not like, about what they have seen in Smithsonian museums. I mean, they've got text, they've got photos. Whoever is working on this behind the scenes has gone in to many museums and has taken photos, and they are documenting all of this. And you can find this also at klw.org and then click on news and your call. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Syeda Grundy is feminist sociologist of race and ethnicity studies and associate professor at Boston University. Dr. Peniel Joseph is professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Peniel, what would you like to add about just how incredible the museum is, the National Museum of African American History and Culture?
Well, Lonnie Bunch has been a mentor for 30 years, incredible leader and scholar. And I remember talking to him about the museum years ago, and it's been remarkable to be able to get just the physical construction of that museum done, given the history of the United States. And the reason why we truly see it so remarkable is that right now, as the country is about to turn to 250, it's gone squarely back to the anti-Black racism that made this country. You know, the roots of this country are in anti-Black racism, racial slavery, racial terror against Black people, but also the super exploitation of Black people. We are the first mortgage securities, and there's great scholarship where we were financialized. You know, it's not just about selling and buying us, but we were collateral and leverage, and we created the first global markets. If you read Sven Beckert's Empire of Cotton, if you read Craig Wilder's Ebony and Ivy, when you read the scholarship on racial slavery and capitalism, right? Certainly Eric Williams, certainly W.E.B. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction. You know, we are all these things, right? And so what's extraordinary about the Smithsonian, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which we call NEMAC in the Black community, we call it, is the very fact that we were able to build that, to tell our story. And, you know, Lonnie, Secretary Bunch is right when he said that in the 60 Minutes speech. What's so important about museums and memory is their narrative power, right? And so the reason why the Smithsonian is so important, and, you know, one thing, President Trump is wrong. It doesn't just tell a sad sack, bad story. It tells a very rich story from, like Professor Grundy said, even pre-slavery, because again, our history, one thing we have to get clear, our history doesn't start with racial slavery. Mm-hmm. Our history starts in Africa, and then from Africa, because of the transatlantic slave trade, we end up global. So we end up in South America and Latin America, we end up in the Caribbean and the Antilles and Haiti and Jamaica. Vince Brown has the great book, Tacky's Revolt on Jamaica. So we end up there, and it tells that story in its totality, but it also tells the story of African Americans who truly believe in multiracial democracy and have helped transform this country for everyone. So our experience mm-hmm. of pain and terror becomes a universalizing experience for justice and love in public. Mm-hmm. And it tells that story in a dramatic way, all the way up into the hip hop, mm-hmm. black arts, mm-hmm. cultural production, the music, the sports. And the final thing I'll say is that when you bring students there and when you bring young people, and I brought my children there, and I've visited the museum over a dozen times, and I wrote something for their first anthology of African American history on the civil rights part. What's so great about the museum is the care that's taken place to share our narrative, right? And so the reason why Trump is trying to take over museums, just like the media, and you think about the Washington Post and Jeff Bezos and the firing of Karen Atia, what's going on there is that this is about shaping the narrative, because ever since the Civil War, America has had two competing narratives. Mm-hmm. One is a Reconstructionist narrative of multiracial democracy. And you think about Black women and men as real co-leaders in that narrative. And then the other is a redemptionist narrative of white supremacy, right? And what the reason why they're really upset about the Smithsonian is that physically they can't destroy it. You see the David Ajay and the design, and it's so beautiful. And that's the first time something like that was built with federal money in the history of the Republic at that grand scale. Because our museum, and I think of NEMAC as our museum, is bigger than the Native American. It's bigger than it's bigger than the African Museum there. And I visited all the museums, the Jewish Museum. It's all great, the American History Museum. But you see the number of floors and, you know, Cy, the great food that's there to eat.
Oh,
when you go over there. I mean, I've had Haitian
James food. Beard winning.
I've had Haitian food and Jamaican food and Guyanese food and West African food. You get food from Zimbabwe, Tanzania, from Europe. It is an experience, you know? And the thing is, it's about Black people because we are Americans too. That's the whole thing, yeah. Right? You know, yeah. Like we are quintessential Americans in the most aspirational, positive sense if we say e pluribus unum, out of many, one, for real, where we're not saying out of many, you know, here are the people to be excluded. You know, we're going to mm-hmm. exclude the Black women. We're going to exclude the trans people or Jewish or Palestinian or anybody. We always say everyone counts, right? Either we all count or none of us counts. And people don't, you know, this Trump administration and their followers are not only are they not vibing with that, they have a complete message of unfreedom and authoritarianism. Because how are you going to control how people think and what people teach if you're all about freedom and the Second Amendment, right? So if you want to brandish these guns in the name of freedom, you're not supposed to have a thought police and a secret police and ICE detentions and throwing people out, right? You can't have it both ways. And that's exactly what they're doing. So NEMAC is a testament to Black people's our resilience, but also it's a testament to the love of each other, but the love of another country. Baldwin teaches us that, where, and so does Toni Morrison, we were trying to build another country, right? A country that was equitable for all the people. And the only way you could get there is to tell the country's experience in its totality. And it's not just a negative experience. Because remember, there are white, Hispanic, queer, other people who were actually in solidarity with us during these years, right? So they weren't, you know, we, and it's this, I won't use the word allyship because we see what that amounts to over the last 5 years since George Floyd, right? It's meaningless. Mm-hmm. But there are some people who'll be in solidarity with us, and that's very, very meaningful.
Well, you talked about where the National Museum of African American History and Culture is located. And doing this show, it was so interesting to learn about where it could have been located if it weren't for people like Lonnie Bunch speaking up. So I want to play another clip. In early 2020, Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman spoke with Lonnie Bunch, who at that time was the newly appointed secretary of the Smithsonian Institution.
How does it feel, Lonnie Bunch III, to be the first African-American head of the Smithsonian and the first historian leading the Smithsonian?
I think that for me, being the head of the Smithsonian is my way of thanking Frederick Douglass. In the 19th century, Frederick Douglass was denied the opportunity to speak at the Smithsonian by the Secretary of the Smithsonian. So when I became secretary, the first thought of my mind was, way to go, Fred.
Wait, wait, you have to tell that story. What actually happened?
So Frederick Douglass was going to speak and to speak about abolitionism, and the Secretary of the Smithsonian said, we do not want anybody Black speaking at the Smithsonian. And Frederick Douglass never spoke there. So for me, this is about saying this isn't the same old Smithsonian anymore.
So talk about the location of the museum and the battle you fought. You almost resigned over this.
Normally, Congress tells the Smithsonian, put a building here. In this case, there was a concern that this would be the last spot on the mall. And many people were concerned that, you know, should that be an African-American museum? And there were other spots that they wanted the museum to be. Places I still can't find. I don't know where the hell they were. But the notion was you had to make an argument where the museum should be, and let's convince the regents in Congress. So I made this argument that, you know, the mall is where the world comes to understand what it means to be an American. And that means that story is incomplete. Look at those white buildings. Something's missing. And I said, the museum needs to be on the mall. But I realized that I didn't have any control over that. So I remember working with Kinshasa Coleman-Conwell, who is my deputy, who is just brilliant. Please clap for her, because she did so much work. And so we brought in some consultants about crisis management in case we didn't get the answer we wanted. And we figured, who knew crisis management? Clinton. So we called Clinton people. And they said to me, what are you going to do if you get a spot in the middle of nowhere that's horrible? And I wasn't sure what to do. And they said, oh, we know what you're going to do. You're going to walk. You're going to quit. So I knew that if we didn't get the spot I wanted, I was going to have to quit. Because I could not let them use me to put Black culture in the corner, in the back, in the dark. But I must admit, when the Smithsonian said, you'll be where we are on the corner of 14th and 15th and Constitution, all I could think about was the 14th and 15th Amendment. Here we come.
That is Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman speaking with Lonnie Bunch III, the newly appointed secretary of the Smithsonian Institution in early 2020. And Saida, I think what's so incredible about these two clips is if it weren't for doing this show today, I would not even know about this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what I'm trying to do, because you don't want to just focus on the dark aspects of all of this. This is really giving us an opportunity to learn more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and Secretary Bunch has actually written a book about his experience, right? Of, I consider it like a sort of a political crash course, right? On what it takes to build institutions, right? Which is so important to our story of the liberation of marginalized people, right? Building institutions that last. So, you know, credit to him, you know, being the historian he is, of actually creating a historiography of the process of getting this institution done, which is absolutely marvelous. You know, I've had the pleasure of meeting Secretary Bunch. He's a very avuncular figure. Like I always want to hug him because he's such a dad. Like, I'm like, will you please teach me how to fish and take me camping? He's really like, he got dad jokes, all these kind of things. So he's a very lovable figure. And one of the things I learned from him that I've used in my scholarship and in the public scholarship about this, the Smithsonian, is that museums are, all of our studies about public trust say that museums are more trusted as a source of knowledge than the media, than school curricula, than like all these other institutions that we think are supposed to disseminate knowledge. The public really feels if it's in a museum, it's true, right? That museums are basically uncorrupted, right, by misinformation, which I think means that it's such a pejorative, such a priority, rather, to put Black history into museums, particularly museums that are not only independent, but museums that are absolutely part of our federal narrative. With that, you know, Peniel talks about, you know, the nicknames that Black communities have for the Smithsonian. You know, another one is the Blacksonian. And I remember talking to Secretary Bunch, and he says, you know, oh, you know, we call it the NMAAHC, you know, we don't really, you know, love the Blacksonian. And I remember, you know, thinking the fact that when Black people nickname something, it means that we consider it ours. When we nickname something, it is often a source of claiming and love, right? We Black people are notorious for giving you a nickname when we recognize you, right, as part of what matters to us. And the fact that a museum can get nicknamed by Black people tells you how culturally sort of towering it is to our sense of pride, right? With that though, you know, the goal of the show is to talk about, you know, this authoritarian playbook. With that, the importance of telling that narrative in the Blacksonian, right? This narrative about Africanity, this narrative about where Black people are going. The reason for Trump's missive is really part and parcel of another playbook here about authoritarianism and particularly fascism. So, you know, I wish that, you know, Trump's missive were more original, but it's really just like on the nose type of fascist rhetoric. And that is that, so not all authoritarianism is fascism. Fascism is a particularly right-wing iteration of authoritarianism, but it requires an imagination. It requires especially a mythic imagination about a past, right? And that's told deliberately through an oversimplistic story about, you know, our national greatness and how our greatness was destroyed by them, right? The leftists, the communists, the marginalized others, the racial minorities, the dissenters, right? And whoever challenges that simplicity of that story, that we used to be great and they ruined it, is always the threat to a fascist regime. And fascism really is a cult of the leader. And so when you humanize the others, when you complicate that past, when you nuance that past, when you present it as anything but mythic, that becomes a real urgent threat to fascist regimes, because fascism is a story in itself, right? To which knowledge is a threat to that, right? Fascism relies on this fundamental idea of the great myths. So, you know, part of what we see Trump doing is, you know, I can't call it an alternate reality. It's an undoing of reality, right? It's a deliberate undoing of a reality of this country, because that is so foundational. That is such, so much the bedrock of the idea of we had a great past and they ruined it.
Right. And Peniel, in our final minutes, I wonder, how far do you think they will go? Because in one document that came out in August, Trump is right about the Smithsonian. They're very detailed. They've got photos of what they've seen in museums. They point out a series at the National Museum of African American History and Culture to educate people on a society that privileges white people and whiteness. They have the National Portrait Gallery featuring art commemorating the act of illegally crossing the inclusive and exclusionary southern border, even making it a finalist for one of its awards. And I'm reading from their text here. The National Museum of the American Latino features programming highlighting animated Latinos and Latinas with disabilities. I mean, it just goes on, and there's photos and text. An American History Museum exhibit features a depiction of the Statue of Liberty holding a tomato in her right hand instead of a torch, and a basket of tomatoes in her left hand instead of a tablet. And then in the letter that they wrote to Secretary Lonnie Bunch, they're very detailed. So in the beginning, they're going to go after the National Museum of American History, the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the National Portrait Gallery. And they say that they want to look at travel exhibitions. They want to look at how much money they're spending, curatorial and staff manuals. They want access to all permanent holdings, educational material. And then they say within 30 days, you have to do this. Within 70 days, you have to send us this documentation, 120 days. And of course, a lot of this is about the 250th birthday. So there's a lot of questions here about the legalities around this. You know, what can they actually do? What can they change? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'd say that they can go as far as the public is willing to let them, right? Hmm. And I think a part of the huge danger of this moment is that historically the public has let white men do, you know, go very far. We think about racial terrorist groups, and they weren't all just the Klan. We think about during the civil rights movement, the white citizens councils, who were the officious face of white supremacy. These were business leaders, clergymen, and women. And so we're seeing it again in the face of the federal government, but really the MAGA movement, right? The MAGA movement has become a de facto movement for just large swaths of injustice, racial injustice, gender, queer injustice, huge xenophobia. Parts of that movement, anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinian, parts of the movement are anti-Semitic too. So when we think about what's going on here, what we haven't been able to do in terms of those voices for justice, especially the Democratic Party and those people within the Democratic Party who are voices for justice, they have not been able to be out there front and center, because the voices for justice in the Democratic Party are not necessarily the Speaker of the House and the minority in the Senate, right? It's different voices. A lot of those voices are women. A lot of those voices, people like Jasmine Crockett, you know, people like AOC and others who've really been able to try to speak out. So I do think they're willing to, they're looking at everything. They're looking at American people's passports. And this happened to Paul Robeson, who was really, his finances were obliterated. You know, one thing, the illegality of this is beside the point. And this is what I mean. Mm-hmm. Authoritarians always do extra legal and extra judicial activities because they sense vulnerabilities in the system and in the institutions and the processes. So when we think about post-war America, the post-war American order globally from 45 to 2025, when we think about NATO and stuff, has collapsed. And in the racial justice order that provided for Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, I argue from 63 to 2013 in my book, that has also collapsed. We are in a post-consensus period, which is why you can fire professors, why you can dehumanize and diminish over 300,000 Black women just fired, and many Black men fired as well. And so a lot of this has to do now with, are we able to defend ourselves on the fly and defend ourselves and then create new institutions? Because it's not about recreating, because these institutions, they've served their purposes, but their collapse and their vulnerability shows us that they weren't built for the test of time. So if we want multiracial democratic institutions to save museums, but for our children and our grandchildren, we're gonna have to create new ones, right? Yeah. You can say it within the structure of the Constitution, adding to the Constitution, but you're talking about creating new ones, including ending gerrymandering, right? Including having a robust voting rights for every single person. So a lot of this is just on us, and including imagining finally a flourishing, healthy community for all of us where we all count.
Dr. Peniel Joseph is professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. He's founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. His latest book is Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed the Civil Rights Revolution. Dr. Saida Grundy is associate professor of sociology and African American Black Diasporic Studies at Boston University. She's the author of Respectable: Politics and Paradox in Making the Morehouse Man. Professors Grundy and Joseph, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.